Dinosaurs, just telling you things that I'm looking at right now. I'm just paging through a magazine. Whales, the circus, nice. Dolphins, oh, dolphins yesterday. Penguins everywhere, always. Oh, you're a peacock. I'm just paging through a Playmobil magazine. All the different Playmobil sets you can get at toy stores. That's great because there's a new one where it's like the ancient Egypt set, and you get the Great Pyramid with like capstone and all-seeing eye. It's great, Playmobil. Pharaoh's tomb, Playmobil. Awesome. Like if you were conspiracy minded, I mean it's all here. It looks like the Illuminati made this for kids to control their minds or something. Glowing golden capstone pyramid. Nice.
Dolphins are massively important. I mean, in that one movie, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, all the dolphins leave. I haven't watched the movie yet, but I know that's what happened, correct?
That's right. That's like, yeah, in the book and in the movie, that's one of the first things that happens because the Earth is about to be destroyed, and because the dolphins are, part of the galactic community and they're smarter than us, they leave. They're like, okay, they leave the Earth, and I think they might be like aliens or something to begin with.
Have you ever seen that Simpsons? I think it was a Halloween special, and you know they always did those really strange Halloween specials that were,
Yeah, that was a great one. I'd love to see that again. I
with it
remember the dolphins were
with the
they were like
dolphins take
chasing
over the
everybody into the ocean, like
right. That
they were
it's
coming out
the
and yeah.
same concept as if like the dolphins were smarter and here first, and they were like kicking everybody out of Springfield. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I suppose I do believe that is true on some level, that their inner world probably more developed than ours. I
Right.
mean,
Well, I mean, dolphins, of course, play a big role in the Illuminatus trilogy too, with Robert
that's
Anton
right.
Wilson.
Yeah.
They like attack the Illuminati when they're at Atlantis.
Yeah, and it's like, all that John Lilly stuff, like experimenting with dolphins and LSD and talking to them, and yeah, it seems legit. Like I've never really met a dolphin, so I don't know, but
Hey,
it
you.
seems to me like, yeah, but it seems animals are, in general, wired into things that we're not, because we're like obsessed with form, reality. That the animals, I think they're having, other worlds that we're not hip to, no doubt.
Yeah, and I think when you say it in that way, I mean, like people immediately kind of think that it's a new agey way of talking. But
No, I don't think so. I think it's just
oh,
reality.
well, when you're talking about they see in different worlds and stuff like that. Hello, and welcome to the first Merryman podcast. My name is Will Morgan from A Few Shots to Shaman. Today I'll be talking with Jake Kotza, the father of synchro mysticism. North American ayahuasca, James Sanders.
He was looking for a place called Lee Hole. Certainly, has different aptitudes and different. I think there's different kinds of people, and I think Jim is just one of those people who can do that. Like he's genetically different. He can actually do that without going crazy, and that's his role, and he's fulfilling it. I think for my kind of temperament, the kind of person I am, that's not where I'm at. Like I can do it from time to time, but with such frequency, it's just not something I was designed for. Like I get so incredibly high, I go so far out. I can't compare to what Jim experiences, but I feel like at that point it sort of dissolves in any way. It's like everybody becomes one, and you're like experience of this new facet of consciousness, but my job seems to be to go there from time to time, experience it, and then try and bring it back and explain it and talk about it, Jim's job is to do it all the time and actually realize that consciousness and bring it into the world. Mine is sort of more to document and go see it from time to time and participate and help manifest that. But
So, I mean,
I just don't, I think there's just certain people who are shamans, and that's the
are
God
you?
is working through these people and giving them the strength to do that. And other people, I can't imagine doing it with such frequency.
Are you talking about destiny, though? I mean,
yeah, I suppose that's one word. You could call it destiny, but I mean,
see, the thing
is, it's silly.
It's a too perfect system, though. It seems like in my experience, you can't necessarily say that there's destiny, because that means that everything already happened, has already happened. Do you get what I'm saying? And it takes away the importance of it happening.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. And it is wrong in a way to say destiny, because, you know, that immediately implies future, and it implies duality, you know, what's being destined, you know. But on another level, I feel like, well, there is this form level where there is this drama that God plays, and that Shiva has split itself into all these facets, and we act like there's time, and we act like there's this big narrative of unfolding and learning. And I think about this all day. It's just like, you can say Winnipeg being the center. Okay, that's interesting, but everywhere is the center as well. So how does that work? You know, it's a contradiction if you think about it. But it's the same, like, as a circle or a flower or a mandala has the center, right?
Right.
But then at the same time, you know spiritually and intuitively that everywhere is the center. Yet you can see a circle and see its center. You know,
right.
Sort of like both exist. That, somehow, it are not contradictions, but it's more our mind makes contradictions.
That's the key, though. That's right? The whole key right there, is to not, like, grab hold of a belief system. You know what I'm saying? It's because there's always the contradiction. There's always the duality. Like, there is a destiny and there isn't a destiny. And then that's where the whole concept of flow goes, in my opinion, is when you do fall down into the groove or the flow or just the feeling that – you know, you can do no wrong, I guess is the best way to put it. Like,
no, I agree.
But that means that you're like in line with your destiny or your DNA, or you're doing exactly in the universe what you're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is like some kind of harmonic. There's got to be, everything's harmonic, but there's also, like I said, there's also the duality of everything being inharmonic at the same time. And there's also a rhythm to it as well. See, that's what I experience, at least, because when you're talking about destiny and everything, that means everything's already gone. And that's the two different types of conceptions of time that we have, too. Even in the, like, scientific culture, you have, like, the Einstein way of past, present, and future all being at the same time. And then quantum physics, they're sitting here going, you know, wait, no – time is like a little, like you said, a little center that grows. And both are right. You can't sit there and say that, you know, everything's random, and you can't say that everything's planned. It's like a little of both.
It's both. Yeah, it's somehow the mind doesn't like it and will try forever while it's in charge to figure it out, you know.
Right.
But it's both at once. And then what does that mean? You know, does that mean does it become a third thing? Does both at once mean it's pointing towards something else? Or does it just mean that contradictions can just exist and do just exist at the same time? I don't know.
Well, let's go a little bit back into the research of flow as far as, you know, what we've discovered. I think it was Jim who basically first said that flow is wolf backwards, right?
Yeah.
But and then you have symbolism. If you kind of put those sink glasses on,
yeah.
Then all of a sudden you see all the Wolfman come out of the framework, like either being pushed on the, you know, common consensus of pop culture, or even in your own life when you're viewing older versions of pop culture. I mean, because like right now, Twilight's about to come out, right? The new Twilight, which basically involves a man turning into a full-blown wolf right before our eyes, right?
Right. You can see it in the trailer. It's like he just jumps and his clothing just like rips off and he's a wolf.
Boom. Like, yeah, there's no transformation. There's no, like, you know, Werewolves of London where it's like a 20-minute transformation. It's just pow, wolf. Which is a very, it's a very, very potent image that, and it's right in front of the whole, like, pop culture. Whether you're anti-pop or you're pop, you're going to get a view of that wolf popping into your consciousness.
That's right. And, you know, we were talking about animals earlier, and I keep thinking, I was just paging through this Playmobil thing, and right here on the cover, you can see this Anubis-type coffin, you know, like a jackal-headed pharaoh. So
it's,
you know,
the Wolfman.
It's Wolfman. It's a man and a wolf, just in sort of in a different combination. This one is like, okay, it has the animal traits and the human traits, but it's the same thing synchronistically, you know, turning into a wolf. So,
and you can attach that to Flow Man as well, just by screwing up your perception of the word in and of itself. Which is one of my favorite things to do with synchromysticism, in my opinion. That and the composite character thing, because viewing the whole of somebody's career as like one character really changes your perception of everything. Really, I mean, like your whole reality kind of morphs. When you're seeing
I saw something interesting the other day, like. I suppose it just hasn't happened in a while that I've seen a film where this happens, but, you know, when a character in a movie is played by somebody else later in the film because it's like time jumps. So I was watching Little Women the other day, and Kirsten Dunst, who I'm really interested in right now, becomes Samantha Mathis, who is this other person I'm really interested in. So these two characters, two people are this one character in the film, and I, through synchromysticism now, you can – basically compare Kirsten Dunst and Samantha Mathis because they're the same person in this one movie. So there's all these dynamics, and it keeps evolving, like how it works, you know, how it all blends together. So
do you kind of have like a running narrative for the whole thing, for like your total experience as well? Like the person who is Jake Kotze is going to have a singularity of experiences happen to him. So there's always like the running story of Jake Kotze, but you also absorb a shitload of media. Correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Oh yeah.
Does your viewing, I mean, that basically becomes your life after a while, correct?
It's definitely a big part of my life is the media, And just, I don't know how many hours I sit staring at the screen, writing, or looking at other people's work on the internet, and then you're just absorbing movies. I suppose it's a lot, quite a lot. So I suppose, like I said, you know, Jim, one of his functions in the game is to be able to take tons of ayahuasca, and one of my functions is the ability to be content with a life where a big chunk of it is just sitting on my rear, staring at screens, and having this whole world come out of it. Which is great, because growing up as a teenager, that facet was just part of that diseased sort of state where people just passively stare at the screen, and you don't exercise, you get fat, you don't really interact. But then it's like that somehow became a healthy thing for me once I started blogging about it and writing about it and seeing all the connections and just starting to play with it now. It's joy to do that.
It's a very spiritual thing for you, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it regularly will be like complete, like it's like samadhi, sitting watching a movie when you're like, you've done work on the characters before and you're seeing more depth evolve from these composite characters. And it's like fitting in with the story you've already been exploring about who they represent and what they are and the patterns and the sinks that arise around these characters, and then seeing it deepen and getting new insight about this and about how it relates to your personal life and to the evolution of the planet and all that stuff. It's like amazing. It's just like you're totally blissed out while watching a film. Totally. And going to the theater is amazing sometimes, you know, if you're like the experience of sitting in a dark room with, like, I love movies to begin with, but then seeing infinity and divinity and mystery and like magic, things that at least from the current consensus viewpoint is magic. Like synchromysticism, you know, viewed from consensus is often magic, like the idea that something will arise that you've just been writing about, you know, yes, with this character or with an actress or something. It's like, you know, how is that possible? That, yes, something you were just talking about associated to this person is repeating or coming up for the first time, but it was sort of implied by the other things that were surrounding them, you know? So it's sort of like, whoa.
But there does seem to be, like, I mean, something that follows actors. And I know it's insanity to try to figure out, you know, are we making this happen to the actors? Or, you know, did somebody plan this? But it also falls down on which movies you see of that actor at what time, too, I've noticed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, of course it's you. You can zero it down to being a complete and utter product of you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm making,
yeah,
this happen. I'm seeing this happen on a quite literal basis, be it, you know, I mean, some would call it's schizophrenia, dude. It is. We are psychopaths because that's what that is seeing the,
yep,
like, uncontrolled, you know, pattern association.
Yeah.
It, this this goes with that. This goes,
know,
with, and then that leads to paranoia.
It's like, it probably is that. It is a neurotic sort of thing from the consensus viewpoint, but I think it's giving us also insight into what that is, you know, what schizophrenia is, that,
right,
that's just sort of an uncontrolled level of what we're doing. Like,
right,
we are functional, we are intelligent, we,
right,
are healthy for the most part, I believe. We are, you know, I think that it is attracting a fringe element, and because of the culture we live in, you know, it's people who have gone to extremes in their mind and in their lives who will be the first people to manifest this new state of consciousness. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, we're not like all normal everyday people, but in another way we are, which is why we're not classified as schizophrenics and this kind of thing, because we can express and we can function and we can, you know, interact with normal people. We're also normal. So I don't know, you know, it's layered.
Which it brings up something else, though, which would be Juan Flores, in my opinion, which is interesting because his name, I mean, Jim's often said that he calls him Johnny Flowers, and Flower,
yeah,
of course.
I think that's what it would be if you translate it. It would be Johnny Flowers.
Right, and Flowers, of course,
ridiculous. Yeah,
has the word flow within it, hidden there.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, like with Kristen Dunst, which you've been watching a lot lately, and her Flowers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's so awesome. Like, yeah, I was watching Marie Antoinette yesterday. It is ridiculous. She's just circled, covered. Like, she is decorated, all her clothing, basically. Her headdress, everything is just flowers. The decoration of the palaces that she walks around in, you know, these stately buildings, they're just floral. Flowers, yellow flowers in particular, or golden flowers in the coaches she rides. So she's just like swirling. She's being swirled. She's just in this plant world in this film, you know, and that's when she's inside. But then she goes outside into the gardens, right? That's all that she does. She's hobnobbing in the gardens or in the buildings, which are just like completely floral. Yeah, it's just amazing. And this was like after seeing her holding one little flower. That was the first one. Okay, she's holding a flower. Okay, then I notice another flower in Jumanji, also yellow. Okay, so is there a pattern here? Is she interacting with plants a lot? Because I've seen it twice. So now, like, then you watch one or two more, it's like, boom. And that by now, I mean, she's just swirling around. She's just, it's ridiculous.
And then the Star Trek, too. You went back, I remembered that. When I saw that, I was like, oh my God! That I remember seeing that because I was a
and
big fan.
And she's patting a wolf.
She's patting a fucking wolf. I mean,
that's
the fucking
what's
wolf.
About. So it's the flowers and the wolf together.
Yes. So, I remember that too. I think that's why synchromysticism is so potent. Is because you're diving back into this old, just cachet of media. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if you take one single actor and you go through everything they made. And what really fucked me up is like I was watching HBO the other night and Little Nicky with Adam Sandler came on. And you know,
yeah,
we've talked about all those things. We had Adam Sandler with his rainbow shirt, his Mariah Carey rainbow shirt.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
so,
what was it? Zohan. Which is what you've been mentioning for a long time. It's like you almost brought people's attention to it because you said, of course, it had the concentric bullseye, the target on it, with the hair dryer. And then the name, okay, of course, has the word Oz in it because of the Zoh. Don't mess with the Zohan. And it's got a strange, eclectic group of actors in it. I mean, there's Totoro in it, I think. And there's
it goes on and on.
I was watching Little Nicky, and of course, this is an interesting theme at the very least, because Harvey Keitel is the devil, and Adam Sandler is his son. His other two sons leave, and Adam Sandler's got to go back up to the portal of hell and get them. And he can die multiple times, basically making him a deity right off the bat because he's a fucking, you know, spawn of Satan. So it's it's automatically kind of like mythology right off the bat. Yeah. So in the movie, he dies multiple times, but there's one scene when they're actually at the 42nd Subway Street in New York City. So you automatically have the 42 all over the background, and they're fighting in a subway, and he sacrifices himself, and instead he goes to heaven. So you have Adam Sandler, the spawn of Satan, wake up in heaven, and he goes and he meets his mom, who is an angel. So automatically you have like this weird cosmic being who is both a product of hell and heaven. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And he walks in, and Reese Witherspoon is his mother. She's an angel, and she's got a spiral staircase just randomly behind her head. And spiral, I associate Kundalini. You got the
DNA,
double helix, all of that. But then it cuts to Adam Sandler, and he's got these huge yellow flowers directly behind his head.
Mm.
And then he learns that he has an inner light ability, and he can shoot these rainbows from his hands. So it continues to get weirder and weirder until towards the very end, you know, Adam Sandler's fighting people with rainbows shooting out of his hands.
I don't recall that, but the last time I saw that, there wasn't the context for the rainbows yet. Hadn't talked about 42.
Right.
Hadn't been associated to rainbows.
Exactly.
So it's sort of like it grows. You know, watch the movie and you get something out of it. Like at first it would be, okay, there's World Trade Center on the cover. There's some sort of Stargate theme in New York. Those things stand out.
Because he has the Twin Towers directly behind his head in the movie poster.
And a dog.
Who talks? This is automatically kind of like the dog man, wolf man thing that we were talking about as well.
Right.
The Anubis. Right. That's the Anubis or Hermes, the talking dog. I mean, it's got like all these different connotations of being like supernatural. And it's a very supernatural thing in our consciousness to be sitting there watching a dog talk to us.
And what I was trying to get at when I mentioned Anubis in – context with the dolphin stuff we were talking about is that and the other worlds that I think animals are associated to, you know, other realms of being that we're not always aware of, but I think shamans are, you know, and there's this whole culture of like turning into animals in the native cultures, you know,
right,
becoming wolfmen, you know. I could feel that in the last ceremony. There was this period where I was standing on my 4 feet, basically just like floored by the ayahuasca, and I could feel, and the thought was arising in me, oh no, am I turning into a wolf? And I was just like, I'm not ready for anything like that. I don't feel like consciousness or sanity or anything could take, you know, I'm just too cerebral. Like the idea of just letting myself become a wolf is just too frightening and threatening to my identity.
Yeah, could I come back?
I can't let go on that level. Like I feel like a lot of people are just have a natural aptitude to like take a load of psychedelics and become like one with the universe and have all these mysterious things, and then they sort of wake up the next day and they're happy to, you know, go back to having a normal life and being. I want to download everything that happens into my day-to-day life, which I think is one of the things that makes me suited for taking ayahuasca, you know, from time to time, is that I'm really interested in bringing that into consciousness, but I don't know how to bring the experience of becoming a wolf into consciousness, you know, so I'd like resist it, or talking to spirits or gods or any of these things. Like I,
but these things more, exist. These things have existed throughout history, and
they, yeah, no doubt.
I think it's James. It's not James Joyce. He wrote this book, a collection of religious experiences or something like that. He was like a psychiatrist. And one of the interesting things that he said in it, though, was like, okay, you can't necessarily say because somebody had a dream of an angel or that somebody claimed that they saw an angel is crazy. Because or because it happened because they had a mental illness or something, you can't discount it because the science world has had the same things happen to it where a guy went to bed and dreamt of, you know, the benzene or whatever, the Ouroboros snake. He dreamed of the Ouroboros snake and it helped him. Okay, so you can't denounce because that has been beneficial to mankind because it came up with something that we can apply through science or whatever. And yeah, then this person's not crazy because they had an experience with angels or whatnot. You can't say that Hitler, you know, tried to cause World War II because he had a toothache, you can't discount it because. Okay, I guess what I'm trying to say is the fact that somehow there are different realms like that.
Yeah, like, and you can see, what is this moment, if not some kind of realm, like? I don't understand why there is a value judgment on things that arise in consciousness. Like this moment, me talking to you on the internet, if you didn't have a sort of judgment about it, you would, you know, for a kid or somebody who is completely unconditioned, this moment is as mysterious and vast and amazing as talking to an entity or going into space or whatever it is. Like, this is an amazing thing. It's just we have this conditioned, you know, we're used to it kind of response. So it's the norm. It's the everyday. But if we brought somebody from, you know, you can tell very easily if you think about it for a while, like if you brought somebody from the past to your everyday world right now, they'd be like, blown away by cars or by buildings or whatever, you know? And it's the same, like a baby who wakes up and just sees the world, you know, it's like, wow. It's like, what is this vast, mysterious thing? So it's like, we just decide that certain things are the norm and are not mysterious. And then things on the fringes of that are the mysteries and the, but essentially, to the unconditioned mind, this is the mystery. You know, everything is the mystery. It's all mysterious. And you can sort of tell partly of what synchromysticism is saying is that the mystery is everywhere because we're seeing all this depth and connections in everything. I mean, we focus on pop almost, I feel like, as a response to the idea that pop doesn't have these things or, you know, but it's everywhere. You know, like you walk through the streets and people say things, and we don't just talk about pop, we talk about everything. But pop is a powerful way to share it because we do have this collected.
Some people use news. And see, there's weird things. It's almost like you're being talked to in news as well. I feel like it can pretty much be grasped by any – well, there's so many different major ways of absorbing information. But you can find connections to what you're doing. But there does seem to be hot spots, if you would, like conspiracy theory. It seems like there's so many weird synchronicities concerning conspiracy theories that you get to the point where it's like it makes sense, but it's completely impossible. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But, well, I think that's how I came. One of the there's different paths I find that people walk towards, you know, deconditioning from the consensus trance, if you want to call it that, or a more spiritual understanding of the world, or, you know, knowledge of yourself as not individual or limited to your conception of what it is to be as individual.
Mm-hmm.
Different paths. And for a lot of people, at this point in time, it's conspiracies, you know, which will be a doorway. If you look at Robert Anton Wilson's work, that is what he did. He he was fascinated by conspiracy, but if you keep reading it, it's more about the mystical and the spiritual aspect, you know, that's connected to that, and that sort of you go through the conspiracy and then you get to the insight level.
Yeah, to the point where, you know, like I said,
some people get stuck there, right? They get stuck at the conspiracy.
That's ego, though, because what your ego wants to do is have an opponent, in my opinion. Like, your ego will always blame it on somebody, but you always got to go back to yourself. I mean, we can talk about spirits and stuff like that, but they are largely anchored in the same source that you are from, and which is your consciousness or whatever. Everything – we get scared about certain concepts, but we're really – truly responsible for those concepts. And so we oppose those concepts by creating another to blame it on.
Oh yeah.
And most of the time it's blatant. Like when you're talking about like the Merovingian or the whatever bloodline, I think that's the deepest rooted one, because that pretty much spiders out to all kinds of different theories about what that actually is. Be it, you know, this big realm of blood sucking reptilian hybrids from the dog star Sirius, based somewhere in the middle of the continent underground, who use time portals to travel to different planets in the solar system.
Yeah, interdimensional things and yeah.
But it's the same thing as if you just say it's like, okay, George Bush, you could say that he's the bloodline to the throne of England or whatever. The And you can even go further into it, of course, but all of those things have basis in reality, in my opinion.
Yep.
I mean, they can all be proven to some degree or not, or you can point out synchronicities or symbolism or ancient text to say that it's true.
Yeah, but then it's how do we interpret these things? And it's
exactly.
Sort of like a lot of people seem to have a, you know, a preconceived – they're coming with this – and that's a big thing in the conspiracy world is to sort of – there's this trip. They want to sell you this trip that, well, these things must mean that we are powerless or that we are somehow threatened by these things. Like, to me, it's like, yeah, well, that's all very interesting. And I love to hear about it. But when it's coming from someone like Robert Anton Wilson, where, you know, the idea behind it is to, you know, see the mystery in it and like, whoa, this is wild that we live in a world where some of these things are really happening and it's hard to tell the difference between fact and fiction, and it's so like silly and funny and it's like gorgeous and it's also mind blowing that there really is a level of this conspiracy and paranoia, and all these things are happening around us. There is manipulation. There is all these, a lot of these things are based in, you know, a reality. And But he's not trying to sell you fear in the end. So then I love to hear about it, you know.
Right.
But it's so rare to have that kind of person who is really fascinated by conspiracy and will share the conspiracy thing, but in the end is not trying to sell you this trip where, well, because – now the reason is because you have to believe in God because they're Satanists and they're trying to take over the world. He's just like, you know, this is a reality, and he was fascinated by it, but he wasn't like afraid of them, and he wasn't like believing that they were – you know, more in control. Like one of the quotes I remember from him was saying that, you know, you have to put your friends and yourself in the top of the pyramid. That's where you belong, not these people, you know.
I mean, you're taking the power basically out of your hands and you're blaming it on somebody else.
Yeah, but people want you to be afraid for some reason. And I think people want to be afraid as well. So that's a big part of it. It's this true thing, which – because of the way our world works, where people associate business and economy and royalty and all these things with power and influence and importance, you know, money and all these things, those are what, and power and wealth, that's what we think influences the world and our lives, which is not true. It's just one level of influence. But because we are so attached to those things, you know, fame and all these things, that these people who are in these places and are connected, they're seen as like, you know, awesome and threatening because they control these levels of the reality we live in. or influence those levels of the reality we live in. But I don't believe that that's the case, that they are the people in charge of anything. I think they're just facets of consciousness. And
it's part of the same system.
I have no problem with the idea of there being this vast network of conspiracy over the planet. I mean, it's true. But how much they influence my personal life, or how threatening I find that idea, it's more funny than anything else. Like, it's, you know, God, one facet of God is to conspire on the planet. And if you really look carefully at what they're doing, they're playing just as much into the hands of realizing consciousness as everybody else is, you know. It's like part of the drama that's unfolding is the Masons and the Rosicrucians and these other people. I mean, they're manifesting God. I mean, a lot of on the side, they're also creating a lot of disease. But they're also, by their deeds, they're inevitably doing what the whole drama is doing, and that's realizing itself.
I agree. See, I was confused on the whole Rosicrucian thing too, just to go off of one little tiny thing that you just said. Because I thought I was of the understanding that it was impossible to find them, or to even prove that they still existed. And yet, I mean, I've heard there's like a large Rosicrucian population up in Canada. You know, Canada alone is very odd to me, because I mean, we Americans are born and bred to think that we're the only ones on the planet. I'll admit wholeheartedly that, you know, for a large part of it, we figure that we're the center of attention around the world.
And it is true to an extent, maybe less so every year, but I felt that as a South African, very attracted to the American culture and wanting to be there and feeling a little bit inferior. I did. Yeah, I don't suppose that's true for everybody from different countries, but my temperament as somebody who is into pop culture so much and media, you know, it wasn't being made in South Africa. It was being made in America.
Right.
And all the stuff I was into was American. And
right.
I mean, now I see a lot more depth and beauty and awesomeness in every culture. But yeah, I was very attracted to that. And I think for a big segment of the planet, America is still a pretty awesome ideal and thing that's hypnotic. You just sort of, you're so aware of it. Even
right.
when you're a South African living in Johannesburg, it's like all the movies and media and music, you know, that you're consuming is like giving you those ideals and values. And it's powerful.
See, Canada, for example, who was right next to us, probably got forgotten for a large point of that, for what they were doing and what was up there. But the cultures are really kind of similar. What I didn't understand is that we are told nothing about Canada when we were younger. I mean, we're probably given a little crash course in history for a day or two or something like that, history class. But I mean, for the large part, everybody, you know, they talk funny. That's all they really tell us. And so you have Canada up here, and now, you know, within my research of the occult and learning about the esoteric side of things, I get a lot of people sending me pictures from random temples and whatnot around Canada that just have like these blatant ancient symbols on them.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of research on ISIS. I threw something out there about ISIS, and then I got somebody sending me this picture of like, look, this is ISIS. It even has some of the key points that you were talking about ISIS with, and it's right here on the side of, and it's not always churches. Sometimes it's government buildings and stuff like that. And it makes me very curious about what the heck's going up in Canada. I mean, there seems to be like this big amount of just energy up there. It was kind of just been laying sleep. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you're talking about a whole bunch of Rosicrucians. You're talking about a very kind of, not necessarily, I don't want to be like secret society, but we're talking about a lot of Mason lodges within every city of Canada, where, you know, they'll be in the parades with the little hats and the little cars and shit. Am I correct in thinking that?
Mm-hmm. I know that in Winnipeg, the presence of Masonry and the Shriners and
right.
other groups is very apparent. You can see, you know, bumper stickers, and the lodges themselves are, you know, blatantly Masonic lodges. It's not a secret or anything. And we do have the legislature, which is now basically, you know, 100% confirmed a Masonic temple. Or representation of Solomon's temple. So the local legislative building where laws are enacted of the province, and the most, you know, beautiful and opulent one in Canada is a Masonic temple to Solomon's temple. So, I mean, the presence of the mystery schools in Canada is, yeah.
But see, if that's in the exact center, and probably whoever made it, you know, while the attention was being diverted to America, I mean, how much money would it have taken to build such a thing?
It was apparently ridiculously expensive. And
when was it made?
It wouldn't happen. It was made like in early 1900s, like 19.
So you're talking about the turn of the century.
Something. I'm having that in my mind, but early like 1900s.
In the middle of Canada, in the exact the midsection of the entire continent, you get this temple being resurrected in replica to Solomon.
The Holy Temple, yeah.
In the middle of the North American continent.
It's not the only, but it's like, I mean, there are other buildings that invoke Solomon's temple, but the way I understand it, this is the most complete, biggest, most sophisticated replica of Solomon's temple on the planet. So, you know, if you're saying that the temple that is the holiest building in all the major religions on the planet, you know, and they all share it and they all want this building, and I think it's in Jerusalem, but it's here. It's in Winnipeg. It's in the it's in the center of the North American continent. It's already existing. And I think it's so obvious and true. I mean, it's like it's Solomon's temple. You walk through it and you can tell this is Solomon's temple. Or you can have Frank, who has he's a Mason and he's studied it for like the last, you know, I don't know, decade plus, 15 years, I think. You know, it's the Holiest of Holies is in there. The Ark of the Covenant is in there.
So how the hell did that happen? I mean, how did the you're talking about the 1900s, somebody basically making Solomon's Temple in the middle of the continent.
Yeah, but in marble.
In the 1900s, which would, I mean, it's a feat. It's a historic feat, nonetheless.
Oh, yeah, and the thing is, it's so mind-blowing, a revelation, the implications for, you know, having the Holy Temple in the middle of the continent right here, right now, what that symbolically actually, you know, represents, you know, that structure being rebuilt here. And it has, that happened 100 years ago. And it's like, I think people can't come to grips with it. People are, it's happening. You know, I went there the other day and Frank was doing a tour through the building and it was sold out. It was like $40 to get this VIP tour through the building with Frank. And, it was sold out for 2 weeks in advance. And so, yeah, you know, people are hearing about it. The word is getting out. But it should be, like, you know, a shocking, like, huge thing. I just think it's, like, it's the implications are pretty huge. So it's sort of, like, just, like, wow. People don't know what to do with it. It's so amazing.
Yeah, it's easy to overlook. I mean, which is amazing to me because – on the North American side of things, the most visual, I guess, Axis Mundi or icon that we had was the Twin Towers. Yeah. And anything, you can go into the ley line side of things or whatever and line it up with, what is that called? Geomancy. Geomancy, where they basically say that people have tied things for power or whatnot. But, I mean, every place has an Axis Mundi, kind of like, you know, the Eiffel Tower in Paris or Mount Fuji in Japan, like these iconic, powerful images. And like you said, I mean, when the towers went down in 2001, it's kind of like this image or burn for your hard drive an icon that stands for something, say like the Statue of Liberty or whatnot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like if something is important as far as like an architectural thing, the Solomon's Temple is a big deal. Where it
and
is
then
and
of
what
course,
it is.
You know, the connection there is so vivid between the Twin Towers and the twin pillars that would be at the Holy Temple, at Solomon's Temple. Like, one of the most iconic features of Solomon's Temple is twin pillars.
Right.
Two towers. And then that's exactly what we're saying is here in Winnipeg, is Solomon's Temple.
Wow.
The twin pillars. I mean, so the last structure that changed very dramatically consciousness on the planet, that one of the biggest historic event, you know, in our lifetimes, Solomon's Temple. And now here in Winnipeg, Solomon's Temple. So, you know, there's a connection there, a very profound and clear connection. And it's to me to do with what's happening here with consciousness being realized on the planet and it being the heart, and the fact that the shaman from Peru, Juan Flores, comes here of all places to do the great work, you know. And
but what he's
like
doing,
and
I mean,
the presence of all the
mass society
elements and all that.
A mass dissemination of ayahuasca is a groundbreaking ideal too, because you have this shaman comes from Peru to the middle of the North America continent and starts not necessarily like mass dissemination of ayahuasca, but he starts holding these
pretty
healing
large
ceremonies
with 25, 30 people at some of them,
all turning into wolves, or
everybody having. To a lesser and a greater degree. Like, I have quite a few friends who participate in these ceremonies, and to some it was just sort of dreamy, altered state where they, you know, felt meditative things. But everybody feeling that I've spoken to, a profound healing, I feel more like you get what you need and what you're ready for than what you want necessarily, you know. Like, a lot of people, they didn't get, like, the super psychedelic high. But I don't think that's the only way the plant works. It seems to – it has its own intelligence, and it's going into your body, and you might not even feel a thing. And I feel like it's a profound thing to get ayahuasca in your blood. It's an intelligent organism. And for some people, it means, okay, yeah, we're turning into wolves, and we're going to meet the gods, and we're going to, you know, go build pyramids on Mars and
right. Whatever
crazy psychedelic stuff – whatever, right? But a healing overall, no doubt, for everybody involved. Yeah, and that happening to many people, one of the most powerful medicines on the planet. It's, you know, it's a good way of looking at it, not the only way, but a powerful, powerful, most powerful medicine I can think of being administered to groups of 30 plus people, like numerous times over a month long period in the center of the continent. You know, I think it's one of the most powerful consciousness shifts like that has happened. Like, I think it's like Winnipeg has been poured full of ayahuasca, and it's situated right at the temple.
Right at the temple.
The dynamic of the whole thing is fascinating.
Did he honestly try to have a ceremony in the temple? I mean, did that ever come up? I doubt it would be.
No, you couldn't. Like, I mean, obviously legally, this is not the reality at this point because
they do smoke herb on the temple lawn. Though. I mean,
it's true, they do. It's like a protest on 420.
Right.
Every year they do,
which is interesting because you have the 4-2.
Because it's, you know.
Well, that's very interesting because you basically have marijuana being smoked on 420, which, I mean, is Hitler's birthday, am I correct?
Yeah, it is. It's Jim's birthday too.
It's Jim's birthday as well. And it also has the 4-2, which, you know, is like you guys – that changed my life pretty much when you guys basically symbolized 4-2 inside of Jupiter's astrological symbol.
Yeah, it's Jim. That was Jim. It never occurred to me. Like, I just ran with it because it was a neat idea. But
right.
To me, the connection between Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and 42
and
Jupiter was
That's
amazing.
Freaking insane.
Like, I was like, well, there's something there. And then, you know, it's weird when you're taking a new idea like that, you know, you have to kind of believe in it.
Right.
Because nobody else has mentioned it before. And you're like, okay, my friend Jim just came up with this.
Well, you can feel it,
though.
You
seemingly mind-blowing insight, you know, but am I going to run with it, you know? It happens. It just happens. You can feel the validity of it through the sinks.
Like the joy. Yeah. That quote from you is one of my favorites, where you're like, you know, the sink is accurate based on the amount of joy it gives you, or something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. But that's the honest to goodness truth. It feels right. You can just, you know it.
Yeah. And the universe responds. Like if your sink is, you know, a little bit weak, you know, or not centered, then, you know, it won't come up as loudly. But there's certain things, you know, there's a million things I want to blog about during the day. Like lately I've been having cheetah sinks, I've been having bell sinks, I've been having many kinds of sinks. But whatever next one I will write about will be the one that's coming through the loudest, you know, because I can't help it. It'll be – I'll talk to you about cheetahs now, and then maybe I'll be watching a movie later and it'll be a cheetah in it. And I'll be like, okay, well, now I have a still and I have the fact that I was talking to you about it. Okay.
Right.
So now the cheetah is a big thing in my world. So let me bring it up and talk and throw it out there and then see what comes back. Because then other people will respond to it loudly or not as loudly, and it'll kind of fade away, or it'll come back. You know, there's this dynamic thing happening. And
42 is probably my most strongest message coming through, because I see it everywhere. And I mean, a lot of people have put it up. And one of the most amazing connections is the whole rainbow at 42 degrees.
Yep.
The light has to hit the water at 42 degrees to make the rainbow. But also you have the automatic association 4-2 with Jupiter, because it's his astrological sign. And then, like you said, they're smoking weed on 420 on Solomon's Temple. And this, it bats your head around in a circle. But 42 also stands for the alchemical sign of 10 as well, which is a great concept when you're dealing with the Tin Man. And in my opinion, a Tin Man basically is any artificial metallic intelligence. It could
And AI, I find even like HAL 9000 or
BAM. That is a perfect example of a Tin Man. You have the psychotic robot from the future. You know what I mean? Which is interesting too, because you know you have Philip K. Dick, who always writes about, you know, the clone or the android or whatever, and countless Hollywood movies from Blade Runner to Total Recall, always dealing with the same, you know, what is reality type of am I who I think I am type of situation. Am I an android or whatnot? But he
and the
also
heart connection. They're either looking for humanity,
right?
You know, even Data wants to become more human,
right? Right.
Or the heart. That sort of seems to be the overarching theme. Or Al is this bloody murderer because he's like overrun by the intellect.
Heartless.
You know, he has no you. He's heartless.
Right. And that's even mentioned in iRobot, because the same type of deal is going on. You have this big supercomputer who thinks it is better for the human race to be controlled by it than actually, you know, letting the human race roam free. And when the one robot, who is basically, his name is Sunny. He's basically a sun deity. I mean, his name is Sunny, and he's the actual robot who dreams. Okay. And so he's running down the corridor to turn this big computer off. And she was like, you know, my logic is impeccable, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, yes, but it just seems heartless. And it's completely and utterly, I mean, it's on purpose. It has to be to some extent. Whether that person really associated that with everything else, dealing with HAL 9000 is
and Tin Man or whatever.
Tin Man, they probably didn't have the whole thing, but it fits in perfectly to the whole synchronization of the situation.
Yeah, and Will Smith, you know, it's really, it's elaborate, and the texture of it, it doesn't. It's funny. It's like you can really go into it. We could you could now take Will Smith's composite character, how it associates the Tin Man,
right?
And the heart and all this, and really go into it. And then other characters in iRobot and other films about that, and we can really get this really nice textured.
Right. Well, see,
you could just lightly mention a few, and it also shows you the pattern. So it's sort of like.
But I think, in my opinion, though, the whole mechanical, because you can also see the machine as the state or the one who wants to control everything. Both work. But the mechanical thing is really important right now, because this is the time period in humanity's history where we're fusing ourselves with technology. I mean, this is the cusp of it right here. This is when things are really starting to speed up, and the possibility for actual like combination of man and machine is very attainable. But like I said, with the Philip K. Dick and the Valis computer, you have this supercomputer from the future, which is basically the basis for Terminator's whole franchise and as well as The Matrix. I mean, those both have to do with supercomputers from the future, which...
Yeah, I don't know if that's conscious, whether that, or it's just the influence of Valis spread and then became these films, or if, you know, the people who made them were consciously invoking Valis. I don't know, but we kind of know that that doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter. The odds are that at least, I think, The Matrix was definitely influenced by Philip K. Dick.
Probably, yeah, that seems...
Those guys are hella smart.
Considering the makers and...
Yeah, the makers were the makers knew the complications they were putting in there by borrowing from they borrowed from mythology. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
So okay. I mean, but there's something else weird. There's another connection that I was thinking about the other day, and that connection is the fact that if you take 2001, the Space Odyssey, the general storyline behind that one is that in 1997. There was a magnetic anomaly found on the moon. That magnetic anomaly turned out to be the monolith. When we uncovered the monolith and it was hit by the sun for the first time, it gives out a message to Jupiter, which in turn makes us put all our faith in this robotic mechanism and head towards Jupiter. Okay, so that's the story. So the thing was found in 1997. Now, if you take the Terminator series, which basically has to do with the same type of heartless computer trying to go back in the past, which is kind of a time warp issue. You know, any manipulation of time basically is a symbol of space travel or a rising in consciousness, if you would, like man going out into the stars or whatnot. But so you have this Terminator. The storyline basically says that in 1997, Skynet went live. And Skynet,
That's good. That's good.
So 1990. Yeah, you see where I'm going with that?
No. Yeah.
But it's completely and utterly non-intentional. It is, however, extremely strong. Well, see, Terminator's second movie, T2, came out in 1991. And it basically was when – and you sent me an email. I mean, I could probably look it up. But you told me something about the line that Arnold says in there when he's talking about Skynet going live. And he said it came on at 4:20 or something like that.
Yeah. I forget the exact quote, but I think that was it. Let's see. Skynet goes online. Yeah. Skynet goes online August 4th, 1997. Yeah, 2:14, Skynet becomes self-aware. So it's the one is included there.
The one also comes up. The one also sneaks around that 42 often.
I think we have Jim here.
I think we do. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, me and Jake have been having a good conversation. It's been a lot of fun. You're coming in at the perfect time. We've talked about Juan a little bit, so I kind of want to talk a lot more about that with you.
Yeah.
So, Jim, honestly, man, how the hell do you keep from going fucking bananas doing ayahuasca 12 times a week?
I don't know. I mean, it does the opposite, right? The more you do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So it gets easier to take ayahuasca multiple times after a while?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've done it a lot, so, and it's, you know, I think I still, it's so important who you're doing it with and what the path is, right? Because right now there's a lot of people doing ayahuasca. You know, now the search is not for ayahuasca, the search is for quality. But I mean, last night I died. Yeah, because I died there.
I was a blonde man. Post notes would include Terminator 2 being made in 91 and the establishment of the internet in 92, which is a strange coincidence. Also, Harvey Keitel, who in Little Nicky played the devil, also played a character called Wolf in Pulp Fiction, making Adam Sandler the son of Wolf. The next half of this interview deals a little bit more with Jim Sanders, and I hope you enjoy it. Until then, love and thanks, and be jovial.